You are listening to the Better 2 podcast with DM Needham. Hi gang, Donna here. Thanks for tuning into the Better 2 podcast. Today's guest is Rich Chambers. He wrote his very first song at the age of 14. By the age of 18, he was playing bars and thought, I'm going to be a rock star. After about a year of this, he realized, you know what? Maybe there's a safer road. And he went back to school. So he got a degree and became an English professor. And he got married and had kids. But during this whole time, he was working and striving to become a better musician, a better singer-songwriter. And at a certain point when he released a Christmas song that got, at this point, almost a million hits, and maybe by the time this airs, it will have hit because it is Christmas close to it, he decided that he was going to pursue his music seriously. As we discussed, he has a song out called I'm So Tired, and he wrote it right before the storming of the Capitol Hill. And he said that he's put the video, which I will be watching soon, and that link will be in the show notes, has gotten a lot of film festival reaction, and he's going to be re-releasing it. So he took a dream, a lifelong dream, and he is turning it into something more. So I hope you enjoy his story. This episode of the Better 2 podcast is brought to you by Kitty Mystic and DM Needham, author of My Days with the Dark Muse, as well as Love is Worth Waiting For. An afternoon at the pool changed Wes's life. When he saw Jin, he knew she was his always and forever. Most nights, Wes spent pursuing his dream of landing a record deal. With Jin looking up at him, he knew nothing would stop him. His dream was fast becoming a reality, until Mason Langford entered their world. While Wes was living his dream, he lost his heart. Now he wondered if he'd ever get her back. Available now, Love is Worth Waiting For by DM Needham at most booksellers. Hi, Rich. How are you doing?
Good, Donna. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Thanks for having me on.
You are most welcome. Now, you are in Canada.
Yep.
Where exactly? Vancouver. In Canada?
Vancouver, Canada. Yeah.
And they do film a lot of stuff there, don't they?
Lots of filming happens here. They call it Hollywood North. Okay. And rightly so. Many times I'll be driving somewhere and I'll see all the cameras set up and the trucks and everything else. I think, what are they filming now? So it's pretty neat with some of the stuff we've had around here.
And then, of course, there's the parking restrictions and the roadblocks. And
but everything else you're trying to, that gets a little frustrating. But then I'm craning my neck trying to see who's the star, who's the celebrity that's doing this film.
I get it. I did some extra work in Chicago, so I understand about all that. And you go down the street and there's these signs saying you cannot park here for X number of times. It's like, all right. So
funny story, Don. I work at Simon Fraser University, which is in Burnaby, a suburb of Vancouver. So it's quite a big university. And they use it for lots of filming. And I'm driving up one day and suddenly it was NASA, something, the big huge sign was taken for the university was taken down. And I was driving into a NASA building and it threw me for a loop. And then of course I saw all the trucks and everything else.
You're like, wait, is somebody punking me? Did like the headphones lighter changed alternate and we're in an alternate universe?
Twilight Zone episode. Yeah. I now work at NASA.
Well, technically you could say that.
Yeah.
Technically, I mean, it's not true, but you could say, well, I worked for NASA.
For one day I did. Yeah.
who's gonna say no, you know?
Exactly.
So you wrote your very first song when you were 14 years old.
Correct. And that was it. I was hooked. Absolutely hooked.
Was there a musician or a singer that inspired you to say, hey, I need to go do this?
Not really, not anyone. I had many musicians. More than anything, though, I think with a lot of people, it's my parents. When I was 4 or 5 years old, I used to remember sitting with my dad, who always played guitar, and I'd sit with them. I remember one time he sat in front of a record player and he was playing a song, getting the chords down and writing down the lyrics. And I sat down next to him. I might have been about 5 years old, fascinated with what he was doing. As he's figuring out a song, he's playing out chords and notes and writing down the lyrics. I thought, this is really cool. And then at Christmas time and other functions, Dad would bring out the guitar, and I'd want to be like him, and I have a little toy guitar strumming along next to him, and nice. I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And then when I got a bit older, my mother really encouraged me to get into guitar lessons because she knew how much I sort of idolized what my dad did. And she was the first one that said, you know, you have a really loud voice. You should be a singer. And it's funny how little things like that stick with you. And it stuck with me. I just kept going at it and going at it. So it's mom and dad were the two inspirations. And then as I got more into it, I found, you know, professional artists and recording artists and musicians that really I got into and started thinking, hey, this is great stuff. But I started with mom and dad.
Nice. And I mean, that's some people, they have very, very positive role model parents that will foster that. I do remember my dad used to play the organ and I would sit there and watch him play, but it was never, he was never one to sit there and go, let me show you how to do this. I wish he would have, but he was excellent at it, but yeah, if I sat down at the organ, it was just kind of like, okay, I never learned to play chopsticks. I can play bass, but I could not play chopsticks on the piano.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm not sure if I'd have to think about it for a second too. I could play it once upon a time, but of course in the guitar world, it's Stairway to Heaven. Every guitar player can play Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah. Yeah.
First few notes.
Well, it's like every time you go to a bar and see a band, somebody in the crowd is going to yell out Freebird.
Yeah. Yes.
Never fails. Doesn't matter the band. That's what you're going to hear somebody yell out.
Somebody will yell it out. Yeah. There's all your standards. It's exactly. Quite, it's quite fun. It's fun. No yeah. question.
Well, I mean, there's, let's say, working in radio. You know, if the DJ had to go to the restroom, let's see, November Rain was a good one. there's several different songs that, you know, it's like as a DJ, you'll have somebody tell you, especially if you're playing top 40, okay, this is what you need to put on. So you have time to go over here. Okay.
A few minutes. Well, it's funny you say that, Don, because I used to DJ for a few summers. I DJed weddings. Mm-hmm. And for me, the go-to was Bob Seger, old-time rock and roll. I plunked it in. I had 3 minutes and 30 seconds to do whatever I wanted to. At the dance floor would pack, everybody go crazy. Never failed. Always old-time rock and roll.
Well, and I mean, the thing is, radio has changed so much that the last station I worked at, it was all computerized. So
yes.
you didn't have to worry. But the first station was like, okay, you have this much time. You have to get around the console. The bathroom's over there. You have to run out of the booth. And you just have to make sure you're back on air. Because dead air is not a good thing.
No, you got to know exactly how long every song was, and you timed it down to you had the seconds down perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
It was Paradise City, not Welcome to the Jungle. Paradise City was six minutes long. Yes, 6 minute long song. It was just like, okay. But that's beside the point. So you decided, you know, you have the inspiration, you're writing songs, but you know, it's funny because I was talking to some people yesterday about fear and how sometimes fear keeps us, makes us take this normal, stable, standard life, you know, and is that kind of where you decided, well, I'm not going to be the big rock star. I'm going to take my time and I'm going to do the things that are expected of me.
It's interesting you bring up fear because fear is such an interesting human condition because it can be the ultimate motivator and the ultimate debilitator, depending on where you fall on the spectrum. Because I believe that to tackle things, you have to have a little bit of fear. That's what gives you an edge and keeps you going. But if you get overwhelmed by it, it holds you back. But to go back where I was, I didn't really have a fear in success because I often heard people say, you've been scared of success. No, that's never really been an issue for me. What I did out of high school was I decided I was going to be a rock star. I was 18 years old and I had that, you know, dreams and images of being a rock star. You're putting up your head. Yeah. I think we've all had moments, you know, and it's funny, Donna, because I barely passed high school, barely. I figured, I don't need school. And then I spent a year playing every dingy bar you could think of, you know, and the best nights I'd get maybe two or three pints of beer, and that's what I get paid. And then I started hearing a few you ain't got it kid comments. And, you know, I had a good dose of ate some good humble pie that first year out of high school. And then I did the smartest thing I've ever done. One of the smartest things I've ever done in my life. I went back to school and I took a whole new perspective on starting into a bachelor's degree, later a master's degree. So it's just quite funny. Just a couple years ago, I was considering doing a PhD, and this is a guy who barely passed high school. So I'm a huge, massive, as a result, I'm a massive, massive advocate of education, all forms of education. So, but it took me, a good sort of reality kick in the face to realize that rich, you know, this music thing isn't as easy as you thought it was going to be. You're not quite as good as you thought you were. And I ate that humble pie. At the same time, though, Don, I decided, okay, I'm going to bear down and start making myself a better musician, a better songwriter, a better singer, better guitar player. And I started a long process, went through many years of just trying to get better and being honest with myself and working hard at it, alongside doing an academic career that led me into a very good job at university later on. So I'm not one who believes that you have to throw all the eggs in one basket. You can nurture a couple baskets at the same time and give each basket just as much dedication and commitment.
So that being said, and I agree, I don't disagree with that statement. The fact is, I think that, you know, there's a couple of caveats here. Firstly, I'd like to know, what did you major in?
English was my bachelor degree. Humanities was my master's.
Nice. Okay. So what I was going to say is, if you look back at you as 18 and you eating the humble pie.
Yeah.
Let's just say, you know, let's just play what if for a second. If you would have taken off.
Yep.
You know, here's the thing. And I look back at this sometimes. I'm like, man, I should have done this. I should have pursued my dream and everything. But the fact of the matter is, sometimes when you look back, you in a place mentally that you could have avoided all the temptations and trappings of that world, or would that world have ended up taking you out?
Great question. I think I probably would have imploded somewhere along the way. You know, I think lots of things. When I look back, sometimes in life, and we've all been there where we've gone, geez, I wish that had happened. And then hindsight tells you it's a damn good thing it didn't happen. I wasn't quite ready for that. And the other path I took ended up, I grew more as an individual down that other path. So there's a good chance if things had taken off, I was 18, 19 or 20, I would not have matured into the songwriter I believe I am now. I would not have had a family and my kids that I have with me now. I would not have attained all these wonderful things that I did attain choosing path B. So sometimes path B ends up being path A.
Well, and you wouldn't be as grounded. I mean, now it's like, okay, so if you had success now, you're coming from a more grounded place.
Absolutely.
And the thing about it is, because of the avenues that are open now, and granted, I know Spotify, it's like being on Amazon Kindle. You get a penny, you know, you actually make a penny per play. I think I make 0.006 per page read.
Yeah, it's 0.003 per play. Yeah.
So, you know, here's the thing. Yes, you're not going to become rich, but you have a better chance of finding success. And there's a lot of people that, you know, radio is a big deal. Well, radio has not got the means that it used to, because people now carry around their cell phone and they have their app, which whatever streaming service they want to listen to.
Yeah.
So it's kind of now you're being able to take things out of the record company's hands.
That's exactly right. It's a double-edged sword. In one sense, you're absolutely right. It's been a huge positive for an independent musician like myself. Suddenly, with a little bit of grin and bear it, I can get myself out there and work hard and put myself onto Spotify and Amazon and YouTube, everything else, which is awesome. But the minus is exactly your butt is 0.00. I mean, I've got one of my Christmas songs has almost 1 million streams in the last 2 years, but that equates to very little money. But it equates to 1 million people having listened to me that 20 years ago, without Spotify and the internet, 1 million people would not have heard me. So it's a plus and minus. So you talk about success. I mean, I define success in many different ways. And I don't deem it as just financially or monetary. And I believe that I'm achieving the success that I'm super proud of and happy for, even though it's not paying the bills, so to speak, but it sure does pay other things internally. Right. That's for sure.
And I mean, you know, with the podcast, I look at, you know, you have the ability to look at stats, and what amazes me is I look at the stats of who regularly listens, and I actually have somebody in Germany, and this is a shout out to them because I have no idea who they are. They always have every episode lately. I've seen them log in and listen.
That is awesome.
Hi guys. But to see that, you know, even though I may not be making money, I still have people around the world that I'm reaching. And that is an amazing thing.
Absolutely. I'm second. I'm with you on that completely. Cause you're right. I mean, I can track my Spotify analytics, and I have Mexico City is one of the biggest streaming cities for me, behind like New York and London. And oddly enough, I don't stream that well in Canada. I stream well, great in the UK, in the US and Mexico, and then Canada comes in there. Canada's still there, but you would have thought that's my backyard. And yeah. In Canada, it's actually the East Coast. I'm Vancouver West Coast, in Toronto and Montreal, those areas stream me. But in Vancouver, I don't get a lot of streams. Every time I see two or three, I think, that's me. And then, that's my friend.
Yeah, I get that, because it's like, I sometimes see my hometown, and I'm like, okay, I did pimp an episode a while ago here, so I'm not sure if it's somebody here listening or did I accidentally click. So I get that. I totally get that.
Great. Yeah. Mexico City. And I have streamers, people streaming me from Brazil. I mean, this is great stuff. Very cool. Yeah.
Because I mean, no matter what, you know that you're connecting with somebody, and that's the one thing I will say with all the technology, is that we have the ability to connect with people on a different level. If you step away from, I want to have, and granted you have a million downloads, but I want a million downloads and I want this notoriety. If you step away and just accept that, hey, you're getting out there. Yeah. And it's reaching people, appreciate that, because that's a big deal.
Well, it's interesting, because I had a moment about 5 or 6 years ago, a good friend of mine who works in local radio in Vancouver, him and I were doing some work together. And I was kind of down on things. And he said, Rich, he said, at this point, is prior to Spotify, going back 6, 7 years, he said, how many downloads have you had on iTunes? And I said, oh, about 15,000. He said, 15,000 downloads. And he says, Rich, stop and think about that. How many people can say they've been downloaded 15,000 times on iTunes? Wow. It was that dose of perspective. And I realized, and I had that point where I started defining success differently. And success, I think, is defined internally. If a person feels successful writing a song and playing it for their friends, and that's it, then that they've had success. If that's what they deem success is, then they've had it. So that's awesome. And I think it's, everybody has their own definition of what success is.
Well, like for me, that, you know, doing the podcast, it's been kind of, I've had a weird success that nobody would really venture to say that this would be a success, but it's taught me a lot about who I am.
Oh, sure.
Listening to other people's stories, it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, well, wait a second, let me think about how that plays out in my life. So it's like, I'm learning and unpacking things from people I talk to about myself. Yep. And it's not something that I would have thought, hey, I'm going to get into podcasting and this is going to be this big epiphany for me. But I have had several epiphanies, and I hope that that's what's happening to the people that are listening.
Which is awesome, Donna. I mean, that is such a great, that's so cool to hear. It's just amazing. I firmly believe that you can learn from anybody, anywhere, anytime. And you never stop learning, whether you're 2 years old or 92 years old. I think you got to keep your mind open. And I think that's what keeps us young, keeps us vibrant, and keeps us connected to our fellow humans. We've got to constantly learn and open up and say, hi, how are you? And listen to stories and share stories. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, when you can step away from social media and you can actually have a human connection, social media connections are great, but when you can actually pick up a phone, and I know nobody likes talking on the phone anymore, but when you can do a Zoom call or whatever, you're connecting and you're getting that feeling, that emotional connection. And sometimes that's lacking in this world.
Agreed. Agreed. I mean, your listeners can't see this because you and I are Zooming, so we're looking at each other, which adds an extra element. If we were just talking on the phone only, it wouldn't have the same connection that we are actually seeing each other. And Zoom's actually been great for that. It's odd how some strange things out of a terrible pandemic, we've actually pulled some great positives. Now, suddenly what used to be just a telephone call or a text message, suddenly Zoom is becoming to the forefront, becoming a way to connect. And I think it's actually a good use of the technology. We're actually able to see faces and see people and make those connections in ways that we were slowly drifting away from, unfortunately.
I remember being a little kid when Disney World first opened, or Space Mountain at Disney World first opened.
Okay.
And there was this, I think it was RCA, had this thing as you took the tram out of the ride of this whole display of the home of the future.
Oh, interesting.
And
okay.
They had something similar to this where you would be making a video call. And this was the 70s. And it's like, okay, so I've witnessed this technology come to fruition, which is amazing.
It is pretty amazing. I often get a kick out of the old William Shatner and Gene Roddenberry Star Treks.
Yeah.
And they pull the communicator. I mean, there's your cell phone. I mean,
yeah, exactly. And I mean, growing up in the 80s, it's like, Yeah, okay. The computer we had was either a Commodore 64 or it was hooked into the school board's computer. You know, there was none of this. This is, you couldn't.
Yeah.
You mean I got a computer here? And oh yeah, don't, you're never going to have a calculator on you. You're going to have to learn math. No calculators in the classroom. Unless it's a
calculators.
Scientific. Yes. Yeah. Unless it's a scientific calculator. Yes, I'm aging myself as always, but
that's okay.
When I was listening to your music today, your voice reminded me of somebody from the 80s. And the closest thing, and I may be way off base, is a comparison of the outfield in Tom Petty. In Tom Petty.
It was like I've had the Tom Petty comparison a little bit at times. I've also been compared to Bryan Adams. I've had that a little bit. Who else have I had? I had one person compare me to Gordon Lightfoot, which I didn't see at all, but but it's neat that people are able to sort of resonate. They're connecting to my music and it's reminding them of other things, which is really kind of cool.
And it's not saying that you don't have a distinctive sound. It was just like, I'm sitting there and I'm listening and I think it was Sorry Isn't Good Enough. And I'm like, wow, this sounds like something I heard in the 80s. Not that it was identical, but the voice and the musicality was just like, and that's good. That's fine. Because how do I say this? Everything old is new again, you know, and the 80s, how do I say this? When we turned into 2021, 1980 has now become the historical section in the romance books. It's no longer just contemporary. So the 80s are historical now.
Well, no, that's interesting. I branded myself as rock and roll for the 2020s. It was one of the things I found very interesting over the years. And I take it as a compliment, but I've been compared to so many different, you sound just like, somebody else say it and they'll name an artist. And somebody else will say, you sound just like, they'll name another artist. And I've heard about 10, 15, I've been compared to so many different artists that it actually tells me that, okay, I'm doing two things. One, I've got some originality. Two, I'm very familiar. So I'm taking all the influences I've had over the last 40 years and I've combined them into my own thing. So I'm original, but I'm also borrowing from everybody else. So therefore I think people, when they listen to my music, they can really relate to it. It sounds familiar to them. It's something that's like an old shoe. And I always say I'm a new old shoe.
Well, it brings comfort. And especially you know, going back to talking about the pandemic, people are looking for something that's going to give them comfort. There is another artist I recently interviewed. Well, actually, it's the end of September I interviewed him, and that was Merchant. And he keeps releasing singles. He worked with John Taylor from Duran Duran.
Okay.
But his music has that 80s feel to it, you know, and it's something that is growing again in popularity. So while we are in 2021, it feels like music is kind of shifting back to the more disco vibe, the more rock vibe. There's more of a purity to it than had been recently, you know.
I would agree with you. I think that like anything else, music is cyclical, like any kind of fashion or cultural trend. And I think one of the things that a lot of people are getting tired of, the perfect auto-tuned vocal track that you hear now, where everything is pristine and ultimately so bang on that suddenly somebody like me and other artists like me come along and I purposely left in some notes I sang flat, because they had the right vibe. They felt good. It was real. It was happening. And I don't auto tune or try and overcorrect my music to the point where it loses that human ability, human touch to it. So I think a lot of people are sort of, they're coming back. I want to hear an actual musician. I want to hear real musicians play as opposed to a computer generated sound. And it's unfortunate because we have some amazing musicians that they're, in my opinion, they're in some ways they're getting overproduced. They're not allowed to be human. They're being made to sound perfect, and we aren't perfect. Humans aren't perfect.
Well, I was listening to an interview because Duran Duran just released a record, Future Past, and John Taylor was talking about the fact that the producer walked into him because one of their last records, he really couldn't hear him. He's like, look, I want to hear John Taylor play bass. I want to hear his bass part. So this goes back to being overproduced. Now he's like, so the producer's like, we're going to make it where I want to hear Nick play keyboards. I want this to be a nice blend where you can hear everybody, but it's not overproduced.
Exactly. So, and John Taylor's an amazing bass player. Let's hear the guy play the bass.
I mean, I'll be honest. Why did I get into playing bass? Rio, you know, Rio, New Religion, Careless Memories. These songs just, they had the bass groove that was just outstanding. And I mean, yes, I know he got his background from Chic, and but I was a little kid when Chic was out. So I was at the roller rink skating to Chic, which was awesome. But, you know, I mean,
it's roller rink. I went to roller rinks too. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to love roller skating. I mean, roller skating was awesome. But yeah, I mean, bass playing was, it was something that I vibed with. And to be able to pick up a bass and be able to play it, to play what he was playing, it was like, once I accomplished this solo in Rio, it was just like, okay. And I remember there was a guy at a bar that I knew. I used to go follow this band called Interfaith. And he had a Kubicki Factor bass, which was just the supreme bass in the 80s. Yep. And he, I'm like, we're talking, and he tried to model himself after John with the hair and everything.
Yeah,
and he
was younger
than me. And I'm talking, I'm like, I said, so can you play Rio? He goes, no.
But you could. Did you show
him? I'm like, can you play the solo? He goes, no. He's like, I can play part of Rio, but I can't play the solo. I'm like, okay. He's like, can you? I'm like, yeah. He goes, here you go. In a crowded bar in Dallas, he hands me this bass, and I'm just like,
beautiful. Did you do it?
Yes, I did.
Good job. Good
yes, job. I did. I
good for you. Like,
all right. He goes, all right. So next week you're going to teach me, right? I'm like, yeah, yeah. So it was just one of those things where it's like, when he did it, it was just the deer in headlights. Like, oh, what have I done?
But yeah, we talked about fear earlier. You overcame it and did it.
Yeah. Well, I was young. I was young at the time. Now somebody would hand it. I haven't played Rio. Well, I should take that back, because he did some tutorials and I haven't played bass in a while. So my husband was still alive at this point. He had gone to a doctor's appointment, and John was talking about playing. He's like, yeah, people always say to me that, you know, when I go to a party, play something or sing something, you know, this because you're a musician.
Yeah.
And he's like, so I'm like, okay, I'll play Rio. And he's like, I played the bass line for Rio. And they're like, what the hell is this? All right. So my husband comes home from his appointment. I have retooled, because my husband had never heard me play the bass. He's like, I think you just own it. I don't think you actually play. All right. So I've relearned how to play it, and I'm really proud of myself. And he comes home, and I plug in and I start playing, and he goes, what the hell is that? Like, you know, John said the same thing, and here I am living it. So
Oh, too funny.
Yeah.
Those are good stories, though, Don. I like that.
So in your little thing, speaking of stories, you said that you have some stories about when you were playing live as a young man.
Yeah. This is one of the funniest stories. I was just thinking about this the other day, and my bass player and I, our band hasn't played together for a few years now. People just went separate ways. It wasn't a sad breakup or anything like that. But my bass player and I were at a pub enjoying a couple drinks one night recently, and I told him a story, and I reminded him of the story, and he couldn't stop laughing when he remembered it. We were playing a frat house at a local university. So this is going back into our late 20s, early 30s, and crazy place. And it's just like out of Animal House. So tons of people there, togas, everything else. And there's this one guy, he was dancing with a very, very attractive young lady. And you could tell that he was pretty excited. And he'd been talking with the band earlier. He came up to us between sets. And he's all saying, look, guys, look, I got her phone number. And he shows me his hand, and she'd written a phone number on his hand. He's all excited. And I didn't take a quick look at it. But then the bass player, he looks at it really closely. He says, hey, oh, you've done, you know, very seriously. He says, good for you. Way to go. And the guy's all excited. He turns around, and okay, and we're about to start our next set. And my bass player looks at all of us, says, guys, we're playing Tommy Two Tone. What? Tommy Two Tone. So we break into 8-6-7-5-3. You see where this is going? We're into the middle of song, and I look out the dance floor, and I see the guy, and he's looking at us, and suddenly he has this concerned look on his face, and he starts looking at his hand, and he's listening to the lyrics and looking at his hand. And then you can see, like, the poor guy just completely dejected, head down, he leaves the room. And then once we realize what was going on, our bass player's smiling, and the rest of the band starts, we could barely hold the song together because we realized what had happened. So this poor guy.
Wow. But you know,
I know that's one of those funny stories that I think back, like, that actually happened. Oh my goodness. That's too funny.
I mean, and that is such a common song. I mean, everybody knows that is a running joke. Of course, once again, maybe he didn't.
Shelter. He was, this is the, so yeah, he would have been, when Tommy Two Tone came out, this guy would have maybe 3 years old.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah. So he didn't know, but the girl he was chasing knew.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody recently, and I mentioned something about NXS, and they're like, who's that? And I'm like, okay. I'm just going to crawl away now. Bye. I mean, there's some, I like some modern music. I mean, I, you know, Nothing But Thieves, I like a lot. And, oh, now, of course, my Imagine Dragons. I mean, those guys I like a lot, and it's more modern music, but you know, I do like my 80s music.
So do I. So you know, you're partial to what you when you were a teen and a kid. You know, I have another funny story I can think of. We were playing this in Vancouver. We were playing this very in a suspect part of town, let's say, and we were playing this one place, and it was a very, very rough neighborhood. And I'm thinking to myself, what did we sign up for to play at this place? And the place wasn't that busy. And we were a little worried that maybe we're going to get beat up and lose my guitar or something like that. Uh-huh. And this group of about six or seven guys came and they sat right in front of us at the table. And they were mean looking dudes. And the waitress says to us, guys, that's part of the Mexican mafia. I didn't know there was a Mexican mafia in Vancouver.
Oh, boy.
So these guys are clutching their beers and they're looking at us, looking very serious. And we're playing about three or four songs. I'm like, oh, no, we're in trouble. And, you know, I was so worried. And then we stopped and we're just about going on another song. One of the guys just speaks up really loud and says, hey, play some CCR. He plays some bleep, 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 play some beep, bleep, bleep CCR. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. And it just so happened, we were about to break into Creedence Clearwater's Fortunate Son. It literally was the next song on our set. So we broke into it and these six, seven guys, suddenly the arms go up, the beer's starting to spill and they're cheering and they're singing with us. 5 minutes later, they're buying us rounds of beer.
Nice.
And then they're starting, hey, can you play such and such? And even if we couldn't, we played it for them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's funny because it really showed me that music can break barriers down. Yeah. It can break cultural differences, societal difference. It's a commonality that I wish we could grab hold of more. And I've put it in some of my lyrics, like my most recent Christmas song I have out, It's Christmas Time All Over the World. One of the lyrics I put in there, I talk about, you know, Christmas is a time for kids and the innocence of kids. And I wish we could grab a hold of that and live it every day. That's one of my closing lines in the song, because music has that power to do that. And I can share another experience where we used to play at Christmas time. Our band used to play a local children's hospital. And these are for severely disabled kids, the poor kids that have very little motor function. They're in motorized wheelchairs. And we used to go there for 4 or 5 years running. We were going there every year and we played for about the 10, 15 kids that were in residence. And this one particular year, they wheeled this one little guy up to the front and he must have been about 7, 8 years old, very little motor function. In fact, it was hard to see him. If he could move any part of his body. It was very sad. And he's there with the nurse and we broke into, I think it was Frosty the Snowman. And I'm looking about a minute into the song and I can see his finger starting to tap to the music.
Nice.
And I had that moment like, hey, that's kind of cool. And I didn't really realize, because I didn't know the kid, I didn't realize how huge this was. The nurse, you could see her eyes lit up and she's trying not to get overexcited. She didn't want to affect him. And she's trying to call the other staff over to take a look at what he's doing. And the entire room just lit up. Everybody was just like, wow. And the power of music. And all he was doing was tapping his finger, but it resonated with him and to the point where he was in the zone with music. And that is another moment where I realized the power of what music can do. And I was so proud. That's one of my most proudest moments of performing. And it was only for 15 kids and we were all acoustics because you can't overpower them with electric guitars. Right. But that it made such an impact on me. And that was about 15 years ago. And it still, I think, resonates, still gets me kind of choked up when I think about it today. But it's the power of music.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, music can bind us together. It's like the force, right. You know, it's an amazing thing. And when one of the other people I interviewed, Joe Lewis, he tried starting a career in Georgia. He tried in Michigan because he was originally from Michigan. Mm-hmm. He's in Brazil now. Wow. And he's like, Brazil loves me. He's like, I was always producing people. Now I can sing. And they love me here. But they also love Lionel Richie. Lionel Richie's a real big deal in Brazil.
Oh, funny. Hey, how different parts of the world latch on to different artists. Yeah.
He's like royalty there. For some reason in Brazil, Lionel Richie is the end all be all. But he's like, I would never have gotten a career. And it's like, but once again, there's a language barrier. But it doesn't matter because...
Yeah.
It's music. I think, you know, sometimes you just have to realize that, you know, you can be in a stadium full of people. How many musicians have you heard say, you know, here we are in Argentina, they can't speak English, but yet they know every lyric.
Yep. And they're singing along.
Yeah.
That's I mean, the, that,
Go ahead.
Music is its own language. It's an international language. We happen to put lyrics to it as singers, but the foundational core of what the music is what resonates with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no wonder, you know, you think of Close Encounters of the Third Kind when Steven Spielberg has, when they talk to aliens, he's doing it through music.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems kind of cheesy today, but you see what Spielberg was doing. It makes sense.
You see what he was doing if you unpack it.
Yeah, good
if
point.
If you unpack it. If you don't unpack it, it's just, you're just going to take it at face value. But I mean, even when I'm writing, it used to be I didn't listen to songs with words. I would just listen to the music, soundtracks usually. Now I do listen to lyrics and everything. And I find songs that I put on a playlist for my readers. I create playlists now for the reader. And like for the show, there's a playlist of everybody that's ever been on the show that people can check out your music. If they don't want to go to your site, there's a playlist on for there.
Oh, cool.
So that way everybody can connect with, you know, what we're talking about. So while we're here,
okay,
about music, I'm so tired. What was the inspiration for that?
Oh, that's, excuse me. I'm getting some great success on that, but interesting. It was last year. It was between Christmas and New Year's of 2020. I wrote and recorded the song. I did it all in about a 5-6 day span. It just hit me and out it came. And I don't know if I was being prophetic or where I was coming from, but then January 6th hit with the storming of Capitol Hill. And I'd literally just finished recording, writing, producing, mastering, mixing the whole bit, this one particular song. And I realized as I was watching, like everybody else watching the news and watching these people storm Capitol Hill, I'm thinking, what the heck is going on? This is nuts. And I was appalled at what I was seeing. And I realized that what I'd written a week prior was how I was feeling, but I didn't really know what I was talking about. So I talked about being, I'm so tired, I'm sick and I'm tired and I can't get up and I just want to sleep all day. And I realized that I was, you know, and this is right in the middle of COVID. This was a COVID Christmas and everything else. And I realized the song was about all these things I was feeling that I didn't necessarily know how I got there. And when I saw all that was happening on January 6th, I realized this is exactly what I was feeling. And so I put together a video along that showed, have you watched the video?
No, I have not.
Oh, you haven't? Because the video is actually, I'm getting, I've got, just last night I got on another film festival. I've been,
nice.
Got 10 different film festival accolades and awards over the last six months.
Nice, congratulations.
Thank you. Because what I did was I took the song and I mirrored it with social media.
Okay.
And I realized what everybody else was feeling. And it was crazy, all the stuff. There's COVID clips, there's Black Lives Matter clips, there's all kinds of different protesting clips, hashtag enough, everything on and on. And it's been somewhat political. I've had a few people say, oh, you know, you can't support such and such. I say, no, I'm not supporting anything. I'm not refuting anything either. I'm just showing you how frustrated and tired people are. So please don't have a look at the video.
I'm quite proud of it.
And I'm getting tons of film festival accolades. And I just, there's a press release out today about how it's doing, hitting so much success on the film festival circuit. But that's where that song came from. It was an inner tired that I wasn't quite able to identify until all of a sudden it stared me in the face when I'm watching people storm Capitol Hill. And I realized it's everything. It's COVID. It's being cooped up inside. It's being frustrated with governments, being frustrated with pipelines and protests and on it goes over and over as so many things.
Well, and that goes back to, I don't want to say fear, but it's the whole news cycle, that 24-hour news cycle that constantly bombards us with this fear.
Yes.
That, you know, we're, for me, you know, we talked about briefly that my husband died. So the fact is he died during COVID, not from COVID, but during COVID. Mm-hmm. So the whole process of grief was changed.
Of course.
You didn't have we didn't do a funeral. We didn't do a wake. We didn't do any of that. And, you know, a year and a half later, let's have a party I thought about doing. And it's like, I don't want to go down that path again. I love him and I respect him, but I'm not going to open those wounds again. So, you know, when you think about it, it's like we are so inundated with fear. So how do you unpack that? And being tired, I think that is a general consensus. You know, when you said COVID Christmas, all I could think of, there's a bad Hallmark movie waiting to happen. You know, I mean, it's a COVID Christmas, folks. And I mean, it's, you could do a short with that. And all you would have to do is just have somebody sitting there alone. It's a COVID Christmas.
COVID Christmas. And you know, Donna, you bring up an amazing point, because you're right. You weren't able to grieve the way people should grieve. And that's with your other loved ones, you know, together. At Christmas time, we weren't able to spend it with our loved ones together. Those moments in life that really make life worthwhile, which when you come down to it, are sharing moments with your loved ones, your family and friends. And COVID put a kink in all of that. And I think that's what made people so frustrated and so, you know, almost created a societal powder keg of sorts. That's why I think some of these protests and some of these movements elevated even beyond the movement itself. As I think people were just frustrated and tired. And that's what I really tried to get forward in the video. I've taken social media clips of all kinds of things from everywhere and put them together to show how frustrated people are. Tired, frustrated. And, you know, and just when we think we're coming out of the other end, something I hear that the places like Austria is starting new lockdowns again and Eastern Europe is having terrible time with COVID. I mean, it's crazy.
Our numbers are starting to surge here again, too. I saw that today. But, you know, going back to when he was in the hospital, just that whole thing, you know, because normally all the family members would come and
yeah, were you able to actually be with him in the hospital?
Oh, I was.
Okay,
and
good.
And I had to get approval to allow one other person to come.
Oh, what a shame.
That was fine. His best friend came, but his family didn't, and that's okay. But I mean, it was just a whole thing. And here's the funny thing. This is what really, it's not funny, but it is funny. So I've been wearing a mask since March of last year. So before they actually mandated, because he was sick. So okay. I get to the hospital, I have my mask on, and they're like, well, no, you have to take that mask off and put this one on.
Oh, a different
which
mask.
Which is a paper mask. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. So I'm going to be unmasked for, what, 30 seconds or so? Why? I mean, all my clothes, if I'm contaminated, if my mask is contaminated, all my clothes are contaminated.
Yeah.
But, you know, hospital rules. It was just, it didn't make sense. It's like, I remember flying first class because I have a friend who works for the airlines. And this was after 9/11. And sitting down with my husband, and we're giving real glasses. We're giving a butter knife with serrations. And I'm thinking, wait a second. I can't bring scissors on a plane. I can't. But yet you're basically giving me weapons.
The tools.
Yeah. Oh, but I guess terrorists don't fly first class. I mean, how do you explain that?
It's crazy. I think what's happening is we're almost, as a society, we're almost getting ahead of ourselves. Like we're jumping, you know, people talk about exponential growth in technology, but I think we're having exponential societal changes to the point where we're trying to adapt and nobody knows what to do. You know, 9/11, suddenly it broke the rule book. What do we do afterwards? And we're trying to figure it out. COVID is breaking another rule book. What do we do? The recession of 2010. I mean, what do we do? I mean, all these things things are happening so fast society-wise. Well, there's your cat.
Yes, Chloe.
That we don't know. We're making it up as we go as a society.
Well, and I think too, part of it is, and this is going to sound bad on my part, I'm sure, some of it's theater. Like the airline going through the screening at the airport to be checked and getting the little cuticle scissors tossed because it's a weapon, but then getting on the plane and being given this. How is that not theater?
Yeah.
We're giving you the warm fuzzy as you're at the airport, but getting on the plane.
There's some truth to that. It's, like I said, it's interesting. I don't think anybody really knows. You know, I can remember going through a plane check, and my son had his math homework in his bag, and he had a geometry set. And they took it because there's a compass in it. So he had to confiscate his geometry set.
Wow. Well, you know, but that being said, okay, I want to go here. So that being said, women should not be allowed to wear heels on the plane then. Because single white female should tell you everything you need to know about that. But I mean, what I'm getting at. So if you take one little thing, then you have to look at the other thing. Then I guess women shouldn't wear underwire on the plane either, because, you know, that could be construed and maybe a belt. I mean, you could sit here and unpack every little thing.
Where do you draw the line kind of thing?
Yeah.
And I think as a society, that's what we're learning how to do. I come back to the fact that things are changing so rapidly that we just don't know how to deal with it all.
No. And the pendulum is so swinging. So, you know, you have cancel culture and then you have, well, this needs to be accepted. And then you have, I mean, you know, right now, and I know you get some of our news. We had the whole shooting in Wisconsin where the yep. kid basically got off. But, you know, and then you have the turnaround argument, which is a very valid argument. What, you know, it was self-defense. What about the woman who is abused and she kills her yeah. abuser and she goes to jail for that? How is that different?
Yeah, it's even our laws yeah. are trying to play catch up too. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. You know, I thought actually going to talk about the Wisconsin, the guy in the SUV that had just been yeah. released last Friday. And a couple yeah. days later, he's yeah. driving through people at a parade.
But wait. Then they only gave him $1,000 bond.
I know.
So basically,
what was he doing on the street? That guy should not have been on the street.
No. And apparently he had done something similar during the summer.
Yeah.
So why are you putting him back out there? I mean, you have that. You have the Astroworld event where, you know, you had all these people that were trampled. And, you know, are you familiar with what I'm talking about? The concert?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's just all these things. It's like, when did, I don't want to say civil unrest, but I mean, if you go to a concert, I was at Live Aid and I yeah. was there during Led Zeppelin and I wasn't standing on my own feet, but guess what? Nobody yeah. died. So when do we become so, I don't want to say barbaric, but so I gotta have that we are pushing and killing people?
I don't know what's caused it, Donna. I mean, some people go to social media. They go to, you know, the violence depicted on movies and TV. I think there's some merit to that. But it's such a larger issue. I mean, how do you, you know, there's a term you're using earlier. How do you unpack it? There's so much to unpack. But you're right. What is it's a scary trend. You hate to see a concert where people, you know, what was a couple of years ago, pre-COVID, the a country artist and the Vegas shooter. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
I mean, that was nuts. It was people and just enjoying a concert, and some guy in a hotel room with a complete armory of weapons. Was,
yeah.
And how did that even get to? Oh, it's just crazy thinking about it. And
I mean, how did it, you know? What? Why is it? Is it because social media has ginned this up, and because we have so much I hate to say disinformation, because some information is valid, but you know, some people go onto these sites and they become indoctrinated. I hate to say it that way, but
yeah, there's some truth to that.
I talked to a woman who she was a Harvard graduate, and she joined a cult. And you wouldn't think
No,
yeah. But here we go. And then I watched part of the documentary on Scientology, and it's just like, so anybody can be told and trained to believe something if they really want to believe it, I guess.
Yes. And they'll find, you know, some people out there that'll agree with them. And that's the downside to what social media is. It allows these people to sort of get together and confirmation bias each other. That, hey, my, you know, we're thinking the right thing. We think similar. That's the scary part of social media.
And Flat Earth, anyone?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's crazy. But there are pluses to social media.
Yeah.
So I hope as we move forward and I talk about exponential growth in our society. I mean, I hope that, you know, the better part of reason wins out.
And the other song, because I'm going to switch gears again.
That's okay.
The other song, Sorry Isn't Good Enough. That you also made some headway with that. So tell us about that.
Yes, that was, I wrote that one specifically for, I was going into a country music fair, and it was in Washington State, just south of the border from where I'm at. And it was a competition, and I wanted to write a song that would just be me and my acoustic guitar. And so I started into a country song, and I had my pickup truck broke down and my dog ran away and my wife left me, and I realized I was going nowhere fast. It was not working. Mm-hmm. I was doing too much stereotypical and it was sounding bad. And I thought, Rich, I said, I'm on the path of writing a very hurting song, but wouldn't it be more impactful if you never explain what the actual cause of the hurt or the event that took place, that why you're so sorry? And I realized then anybody can fill in their own gap. Because we're all sorry for something. We all have moments in our lives where we regret or feel bad on a relationship, or whether it be a friend or a girlfriend, boyfriend, or husband, wife, whatever, where we've done something we feel bad about. So I kept the complete sorry isn't good enough. And the narrator never tells you what they're sorry for or what they did to feel that regret. And then the song just flowed out. 30 minutes later, I had it all completely written because I found my place and where it was going to go, and away I went. So I'm quite proud of that one. A funny story, though, I went to the fair. I finished fifth that day. And I try and sell myself fifth is pretty good, except there were only five contestants in the fair that day. So so I always say fifth instead of last. You know?
Yeah, fifth has a better sound to it. And, you know, it just happened to be that there was no other contestants that day. That's all. You know, so, you know, here's the thing, though. Even if you were fifth, you still put yourself out there.
I was out there.
That's the key.
And I loved it. And thank you for bringing that song. I'm very, very partial to that song. It's, as a writer, I'm proud of everything I've written, but certain songs I'm a little bit more so proud of. And that's one of the ones that, because I think I nailed it. I really feel good that I nailed that regretful hurt that anybody, and we've all experienced at some point.
If we're honest,
yep. Yeah.
There's a lot of people that'll say, oh, I've never been hurt.
Okay. It wasn't me. It was them. Me. You know,
I think that comes with age, though. I think when you get a little older, you look back and go, OK, let's unpack this and see. All right. Yeah, maybe this is where I had some fault.
Yeah.
But I don't think everybody's willing to do that. Some people will live a bit oblivious.
I mean, relationships that almost always there's two sides to a relationship. And, you know, some are, when you're talking about extreme cases like abuse, no, whole different ballgame. But the average, when two people go their separate ways, usually they both contributed something to going their separate ways.
Yeah, definitely. So what do your parents think of this?
Well, unfortunately, mom passed away quite a few years ago. So she never hit in a car accident, which is a shame. I was younger. So she never got to meet, I only got to meet two of her grandchildren, my brother's kids, not my kids, unfortunately.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. But it's amazing. You learn from these things that you go through in life. And mom would be very proud of me. And I believe that she's here in spirit with me all along. And I have friends every now and then remind me, say, Rich, your mom would be so proud of what you're doing right now. My dad's extremely proud. And no question, he always asks me, how are you doing? And he gets excited. Him and my stepmom get very excited about when they see new things and new press and things that I'm doing. And they're always on social media and saying, way to go, Rich. Good for you. And so it's neat to see. It's great, that kind of support.
Have you ever thought about doing a song with him? Or is his hands now because...
It's harder for him. Yeah, he had a problem with his playing hand. And my one regret is him and I have never actually we've never played together. We've been in places where we've had one guitar and we've traded it back and forth and sang songs, but we never had two guitars and played together. And that's one thing that I got to make sure, because he's the early 80s now, I got to make sure while he can still play that we get together with both our guitars and play a few songs.
One thing I did with my grandmothers before they passed was I sat down and I said, tell me the family history, your version of it.
And, oh, that's great.
Yeah, I didn't get to do it with my dad. I wish I did. But and he's still around, but he can't hear. So it's not that easy at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know. It was an interesting journey, because it's like there's certain things that you didn't know. And I mean, I remember, I want to say 2006, so I was in my late 40s. My uncle tells me, did you know your dad was emancipated? I'm like, excuse me, what are you talking about?
Wow.
No, and my dad never told me. It was my uncle that told me that my dad did this. And I'm just like, no. So, but, you know, the family secrets you don't know.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to release a Christmas record?
Oh, I've always been a massive, massive Christmas fan. No question. So initially it, was when I finished university, my bachelor's degree, this is prior to Spotify and the internet, MP3 craze. So it was all CDs and cassettes. And, two things. One, my love of Christmas, and two, as a new artist, I thought Christmas songs are familiar. You know, they don't know who I am, but they know who Frosty the Snowman is. So I got to do my version of Frosty the Snowman. And I love doing all this Christmas stuff. And so I put out this CD years ago and pushed it hard for a couple of years, mild success with it. And then at that point, I got married and started having a family, and I kind of pushed it aside. Always still kept playing, never lost playing. I always played in the band and things like that, but I wasn't promoting it heavily. And then I discovered that this one song, Snow Miser versus Heat Miser, from my initial Christmas CD, was starting to make inroads. Now, at this point, iTunes had come along, and I just happened to throw it up on a whim, and suddenly I'm getting downloads every Christmas, like 1,000 downloads or 1,500 downloads. And over the years, finally, I got to a point, and I think I told you when I first contacted you, I had this epiphany where I looked in the mirror, and this is going back a couple of years, and I said to myself, Rich, why are you not doing this passion of yours? And I sort of let this, the metaphorical mirror that we all look at some point in our time, in our lives. And I was looking hard at myself and I had no answer. I could not honestly say why I wasn't doing it. So right then and there, I decided I'm going to do it. I'm going back in music. I'm going hardcore and I'm pushing it as hard as I possibly can. And I thought, where do I start? I'll take this one Snow Miser song that was a success years ago and I'll package a brand new Christmas album around it. So this one Snow Miser song, that's the one that's been down close to downloading a million times soon. This Christmas season, we'll get there. It's almost there now. And that song became the cornerstone. And I'd written over the years, I've written a few more new Christmas songs and I packaged them all together in this Christmas album that I put out last year. And at first I started recording it myself and I started working with other people and I was not getting the sound. I kept coming back to doing things myself. And now I'm doing everything myself because nobody else could quite get the sound I was after. Yeah. But thanks for asking, Don. I'm super proud of the Christmas stuff. And I love Christmas. The album's made up of mostly songs I grew up with. Snow Miser, Heat Miser was a special I saw as a kid. The year was out of Santa Claus. Well, I must have been 6 years old.
I was going to say that the Miser Brothers was, yep. That's something, yep, that people talk about, but it's not a song that is ever really covered. I mean, no. When I worked for me, I know you like Christmas, and it's not that I don't like Christmas, but being in a dish jockey booth,
fair enough,
Christmas Day, playing Christmas music for 4 hours, 4.5 hours, 5 hours, and you have to listen to Jingle Bells, I don't know how many times.
Over and over again.
It gets really old. So, I mean, I guess it's like working retail, except the problem is you kind of hear it unless you pod the mic, you know, pod the speakers, yeah, down. And you can't do that because you got to make sure everything's still playing.
You got to know when your cues are, sure, and all of that stuff. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's something, I know why it's hit almost a million, because that is one of those songs that's not covered, but everybody knows it.
Nobody does it. Yeah. And nobody's really covered. There's been a couple of covers, but they've changed it so much that it doesn't really resonate with the vibrancy and the fun of the first version. And that's what I wanted to make it as fun as that original version on the TV special. And I think I got it, and it seems it's been resonating with people. So I'm super proud of that. And so I built another Christmas album where I wrote 4 of my own songs on there. I did my version of Frosty the Snowman, which I loved. I did The Grinch, which I loved as a kid. I did Snoopy's Christmas, which I loved as a kid. And I just did all these songs and found a couple other ones along the way that were somewhat obscure that I really liked and threw them into a Christmas album. And I'm having fun with it.
That's the thing. If you release something that is a touchstone for a lot of people, but yet it's not common, it's going to stand out more.
And that's bang on sort of my philosophy when I put this initial album together, Adonis, because everybody's got a Christmas album. And, you know, you hear Silent Night 100 zillion times, as you said, you know, my Jingle Bells, you heard a billion times, but I decided to make my Jingle Bells a rockabilly Jingle Bells. And I tried to put a different spin on it, which I also did with The Grinch and with Frosty and things like that. But I tried to stay away. Snoopy's Christmas hasn't been covered that much. I found an old country artist by the name of Eddie Arnold who did a Christmas song from the late 40s that I absolutely loved. And I decided to do my own version of it. I took We Three Kings and took it out of 3/4 time, put it into straight 4/4 rock and roll time and put some drums behind it and made it into a rock and roll version. So, and I wrote 4 of my own, which I really wanted to try and get a different feel to them. I called the album Santa's Rockin' Band because the song I wrote, Santa's Rockin' Band, was the first commercial song I ever wrote and released. And my Facebook and Instagram hashtags are at Santa's Rockin' Band. It's sort of to signify, here's the first song I ever wrote myself and commercially released.
Nice. One of my favorite Christmas records is Brian Setzer's.
Oh, I know. Great stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's upbeat. It's not your traditional stuff. And that's why I like it. You know, there's certain Christmas songs now that I'm just kind of like, okay. And of course,
here we go again.
You know,
yeah.
I will say, yes, Do They Know It's Christmas is still a big song for me, but I went to Live Aid, so it was life-changing. Without that song, Live Aid wouldn't happen.
It's a good song.
Yeah.
It's a good song. There's no question. There's a few that resonate with me. Happy Xmas War is Over. John Lennon has always resonated with me. And there's a few that really make a difference.
Carol of the Bells, I always love.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Merry Christmas, Baby. What is it? Christmas Baby, Please Come Home, Darlene Love. Absolutely. I absolutely love that stuff. But then when you hear so-and-so do Rock Around the Christmas Tree for the 100th time, like, oh no, not again, not again.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think as an artist, it's like, I mean, you took a risk, but you also, we've talked about, you've taken obscure songs or a little bit more obscure, but when you're an artist, like, okay, I'm putting out a Christmas record. Okay. Is it the same songs that everybody else has done?
Yep.
And unless you're a diehard fan, how much of a sale are you going to have? I mean, bands put out cover records all the time.
Yep.
And some meet with commercial success, but most don't.
It's tough to do a cover. People don't realize how hard it is to, because I think you've got to strike this balance to have a successful cover. You have to be very respectful of the original, but you also have to add a little bit of yourself into it too. So it can't be a carbon copy, and you can't go so far out there that people go, what the heck is that? So you got to find this middle ground, and some artists are able to hit it every now and then, and you get great cover versions of songs.
Yeah. And then you have the solid gold versions of the song back in the 80s where Dionne Warwick was singing some stuff and you're like, what?
What on earth is that? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, that's not how that song goes.
Yeah. So true. So true. So and now, I mean, now I'm releasing original music, and I still have I have an album coming out in early 2022. There'll be a couple of covers on it, just because I absolutely love the songs that I'll be covering on it. But I firmly believe that as a new artist, you got to make it with your original material.
Now, is this going to be something that is going to be a physical product, or are you just going to stick with the downloads?
Sticking with the downloads for now. As much as I would love to produce LPs and CDs, they cost a lot of money.
Oh yeah.
And then you got to get into distribution and everything else. And I'm not up to that level yet. I'm striving for it. There's no question. I'm striving for it. But it's all right now. All my time is spent on marketing via the net, marketing via sometimes old school telephone. I pick up that phone and make a call. But marketing is huge. I mean, creating the music's only half the journey. The marketing is the other half.
That's with anything, whether it's book or anything.
Yeah. And good point.
And here's something that, you know, like TikTok blew up with this thing called Book Talk. Well, in the last 2 weeks, the algorithm has changed. And I don't know how many authors on TikTok are now going, well, my posts are only getting 100 views. They were getting like 800 before.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing about marketing. It's like, once you think you've got your stride, you know, your stride down and you're going, the algorithm's changed and the game has flipped.
Yep.
So you have to figure it all out again.
And if you're following the trends, then chances are you're already too late to that trend. Yeah. You got to be ahead of the game. You got to be doing something and thinking, nobody else is really doing this, but I'm going to try it. Yeah. And that's where you either fall flat or you get some great success. But that's part of what the risk taking is all about. You have to be prepared to put yourself out there, take a bit of risks. So marketing in some ways is like performing. Anybody who's performed knows that when you step out on stage, you're taking a risk. You're putting yourself out there. Marketing's a similar thing. You're taking a risk. You're putting yourself out there and away you go.
And I think, you know, with the pandemic that has happened, because I talked to somebody about this recently, the fact that people are leaving their jobs. People are like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to follow my passion.
Yep.
And in the grand scheme of things, as technology grows, we're going to have more automation. So some of the jobs that, you know, we did as kids are not going to be done by people anymore.
Correct. Correct.
So our whole lives are changing. I mean, you don't even have to go in the grocery store anymore.
Yeah.
You can have somebody do your grocery shopping for you.
Bring it to you. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, exactly. So
in a way, you know, if they're going to deliver to your house, how much of a shut-in can you become? Secondly, though, how much creativity are we going to see grow and blossom because people are finally going to take and say, you know what? I'm going to pursue my passion. I'm going to take control of my life.
It's a great question. And, you know, to give you a bit of snapshot into that, during the pandemic, I was at my local music store and I was picking up some strings and I was talking with the guys there and I asked them, how's COVID been for you guys? And they said, Rich, you would not believe how busy we've been. Everybody's buying guitars, pianos, instruments, their recording equipment, because now people are getting into it, or they're doing these projects they put off for years and now they're diving in. So it's amazing. And how many people that you don't see are in there. They're now saying, I'm going to tackle that novel away I go. I'm going to knit that sweater I've been thinking about forever. I'm going to paint that painting I've been thinking of forever. I mean, and I love that. It's a shame that it's taking a pandemic to get people to sort of dive into some of their passions. I think it's important to carve out time in our lives, no matter what, for these passions. It's important.
Well, and if you think about it, you know, right, everybody talks about self-care. And mm-hmm. really, when you're doing something that you're passionate about, it's part of self-care.
Absolutely.
Because it's fulfilling.
Sure it is. I mean, sometimes I look at the clock and I realize I've been sitting here recording this guitar part for 4 hours and it seems like 20 minutes because mm-hmm. I love what I'm doing. When you're passionate about it, it doesn't seem like work.
I remember it was this past Mother's Day. I was sitting at my keyboard and I was working on a chapter in a book and I had taken some breaks, but ultimately I wrote over 6,000 words that day. And I'm like,
that's a lot.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. But once again, though, I was in the flow. I was passionate about what I was doing. Yeah. It wasn't pulling teeth. So when you're in the flow, it's easy enough to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's other days where I can't. I'm lucky if I break.
Yeah, of course.
But it goes back to what we're saying before we got on is I'm going to sit down and write that hit song. It's not that simple.
It's not that simple. There's so much involved. And passion's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the most successful, and I won't just say artists, people are successful in almost any industry and any endeavor have a passion somewhere for what they're doing. That's what sort of, in some ways, that's the foundation for success.
There's person that are that love analytics that just, I look at my analytics and I'm like, okay, I can generally see what's going on, but there are people that will dissect that down to the most minute detail and they love it. You know, one of the things I liked about insurance was the research I had to do and the investigation. Yep. The rest of the other stuff, I hate it, but there was still that little bit. So, go ahead.
I said, and that's what makes the world go around on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to be a doctor, but there's people that have a passion for that. And other people look at me and say, Rich, how on earth can you ever create a song? And yet a song will bring a joy to people, make them dance, get up on their feet. I mean, that's what makes the world go around. We all have different passions, and thank goodness for that.
True. I will ask you one last question. So sure. Your kids, how are they, they taking dad being the musician?
They've always been extremely respectful of it. At this point now, they're 17 and 20. My oldest is a piano player and plays clarinet as well. And they've been extremely supportive. And I think, though, that they still think, you know, dad, you're not quite that cool. You don't really know. Every now and then I try and talk about something and they go, oh, dad, you sound like such a boomer. And I go, I'm not a boomer. I'm not the boomer generation. I'm beyond that. I'm the generation X. They said, no, dad, you're a boomer. And they push me back even further, make me older than I am. it's fun. They're very supportive.
So would you ever work with one of your son, you know, with your son that's the musician?
Probably not, because it's as much as he enjoys music, it's not the same passion for him. He respects that it's my passion, and I respect that his passions have gone in other directions.
Understand. Yeah, I had somebody last night actually tell me he's a millennial. He's like, you're actually a really cool lady. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty awesome. You know, because I'm Gen X and it's like, well, we are that generation that, I love the meme that's like, we're the generation that basically dislikes both of you guys.
Yeah.
It's not true. I mean, I don't dislike the boomers and I don't dislike the millennials because I have all people on my show, but it's like sometimes the thinking process, you're just like, what the heck?
Well, we're the sandwich generation, Donna. We grew up in a different time. And yet as we got older, we realized we had to grow with the new technology.
Yeah.
So in some ways we can relate to the boomers and past generations the way millennials and Gen Z can't. We can also relate to the Gen Z millennials. We're that sandwich generation.
Perfect analysis. Maybe that's what we should be. We'll just call us the sandwich gen. And I know what you're talking about. I mean, when I was working, when I got my first computer, it was just like, okay, I know what I'm doing after high school, I put the computer in a loop with the school board, but that's beside the point. I didn't know what I was doing. They already had a class that had already been through the coding process. They were there too. And then the teacher's trying to teach us secondary and she's not paying attention to us. She's all about the other class. So I put one wrong keystroke and I put the computer in a loop, making this banner for like 2 days. Yeah.
Broke the computer. Way to go.
I did. And I mean, at the time it was all just terminals. So it was hooked up to the central computer.
Yep. Of course.
So I got demoted to the Commodore 64 and I was not allowed to play anymore.
There you go.
But you know, when I got my first computer, it was like, no problem. And I remember being at my company and there was a guy who I worked with who was older. And it was like, every time something screwed up, he's like, hey, can you come here? Sure. Because he was going to break it. He was just like, I really just want to throw it out the window. For me, it was just like, okay, I got it. And they're still now. It's like, I wish I knew more about technology because I have no idea about cryptocurrency. I have no idea about any of that. And it's like, that's where things are going. People, like an artist was telling me last night that he, I think it's an NTF.
The MTF.
There are a lot of artists that are funding their projects that way. And I'm just like, what is this?
Yeah, the blockchain is a very interesting new concept. And it's, I think, not just cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency utilizes blockchain, but blockchain has so much more potential in so many different ways. And it's going to become, in my opinion, a much more known entity over the next decade, blockchain. So watch out for it. I mean, in a good way. I think it has, the technology itself has all kinds of positive potential.
The funny thing is, I live in a small town and we already had five banks and they just built a brand new bank. And I'm like, why would you do that with cryptocurrency and everything else coming to the fore? Why?
Well, cryptocurrency will take a while. But the technology that cryptocurrency uses, the blockchain technology, will start getting used. NTFs is a great example. It's going to start to get used in all kinds of other ways. So it's cool stuff. I know a little bit about it, but not a huge amount, but enough to know that it's pretty cool.
I guess this is where the Gen X here, the sandwich generation, will need to learn. That way we don't get left behind.
We'll have to learn. So, see, we grew up learning because computers were put in our hand in our 20s. And like our preceding generation said, I'm almost retired. I don't have to learn this. We had to learn it. So we have the foundations of being able to adapt to technology.
Yes. Well, you know, if you had the technology, you build it, or whatever the $6 million man was, you know, how they were
the $6 million man, Lee Majors.
Yes.
We have the technology. We will build him.
There you go. I remember
the series.
Yes. That's what I was trying to think of. So I thank you for your time. Is there anything that we did not cover that you would like to add?
No. Other than a Merry Christmas to everybody that time of year. I mean, happy holidays and happy seasons, that sort of thing. And, enjoy the Christmas holidays with your family and friends.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the show. It's been awesome.
Thanks, Donna. I've had a lot of fun. Thank you.
So the conversation with Rich was interesting. Kind of like always, it's the coffee shop conversation of you sit down with somebody and off on a tangent you go. But I think in a way, you know, he had a lot of good information and he will come back on the show when he has his record coming out. We've already discussed that. And I think he's going to be going places. He has a way of promoting himself and he's learned a lot of valuable lessons. The thing is, and the one thing I will share with people that are younger, and you may disagree because I know you guys are a little bit more fearless than we are, but you know, sometimes maturity, the being older keeps us safer, and that's okay because the trouble that he or myself would have got into had we actually pursued the musical dream when we were 18 or 19, well, it might not have been the best. So pursue your dream, but make sure you stay grounded. Make sure that you have reality-based thinking, because while it would be lovely to have the sold-out world tour, is it everything you really think it is? Or is it going to come at you so hard and so fast and turn your world completely upside down and almost suffocate you? You have to be true to who you are. And remember that. Remember who you are. And at 18 or 19, you don't really always know who you are. You think you do, but it takes a long time to unpack everything and figure that out. So I hope you enjoy the show. You know, check out his Christmas record. It's on Spotify. And like I said, the links are in the show notes. And as always, so are all of our social media links, as well as our Patreon. So if you like the show, please help support it. And let's see, this is season 4 now. So I can't believe it. Season 4. And well, this is Christmas Eve. So I wish everybody a very Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. However you decide to celebrate. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Yule, you know, Merry Christmas, Happy Christmas for those in the UK. Feliz Navidad, I think. Well, there's so many more I could say, but I wish you guys the very best holiday season. And, you know, I have a couple more episodes before New Year's, but in case you don't get to hear it because of the holiday, Happy New Year too. And may 2020 be a much better year. So, or excuse me, 2020. Whoa. No, we don't want to go back to 2020. 2022 be a much better year. Most likely we'll edit that out. Anyway, so I hope you enjoyed the show as always, and I'll catch you next time. Bye, guys.
You're listening to the Better 2 podcast with DM Needham. We'll be right back.